This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Lest anyone doubt the power of speech, just 4 years ago, the country heard these words at the Democratic National Convention, delivered at the time by a virtually unknown state senator from Illinois.
There are those who are preparing to divide us, the spin masters, the negative ad peddlers, who embrace the politics of anything goes. Well, I say to them tonight, there is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America.
And today, Barack Obama is poised to become the 44th president of the United States. And while he is blessed with many political skills, even his adversaries concede that he has a special gift for oratory. Vernon Jordan knows well the power of speech. Born in the segregated South and raised in the oratorical tradition of the African-American church, the boy who would become a civil rights pioneer learned early that he had a knack for public speaking at the children's Easter Sunday services at the St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church in Atlanta. From those early days in Georgia through college and law school, the courts and the courts of public opinion, Vernon Jordan used his oratorical gift in hundreds of speeches around the country. He's collected several with notes to put them in context in a new book called Make It Plain. Vernon Jordan joins us in just a moment. Later in the program, NPR Ombudsman Lisa Shepard on NPR's campaign coverage and allegations of bias. But first, the power of oratory. What was the greatest speech you ever heard? How did it change your mind and direct your actions? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk at npr.org. You can also tell us your story on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Vernon Jordan joins us now from our bureau in New York. He's managing director of Lazard Frere, and you may remember his association with the Urban League, the United Negro College Fund, or his long and close friendship with Bill and Hillary Clinton. His new book is titled Make It Plain, Standing Up and Speaking Out. And Vernon Jordan, nice to have you on the program today.
Neil, it's nice to be on the program. How is the weather in Washington?
The weather in Washington is nice and warm today, and, well, everybody's looking for a big change in the weather in a couple of months' time. But I have to ask you, in retrospect, it seems pretty obvious that speech we just heard a snippet of 4 years ago to the Democratic National Convention, that speech changed history.
There is no question about it. At the Democratic Convention in Boston, a new star on the American political scene was born, and that star is now the president-elect of the United States.
When you heard that speech, as opposed to the content, which was pretty great too, but as you listened to his technique, what did you admire?
Well, it was clear that he had been doing it for some time, and I guess it, you know, doing the campaign for the Senate, doing the campaign for the Illinois Senate. It was also clear that he enjoyed what he was doing. I do not believe that you can give a good speech if you don't like doing it. And so as I watched, I knew him before that speech and before he was elected to the United States Senate. And even in the conversation at lunch when I first met him, There was an elegance and eloquence that I found very impressive. So it's no surprise to me that he has come thus far.
It is something to run for the state senate in Illinois. It's another thing to address an enormous convention, national television, all that pressure. And the way, just in that snippet, he used that technique of getting the applause line and then lifting it off the applause line, coming in while the applause is still going and building from there. Boy, that's practice technique.
Well, that's right. And I think the comparison is that John Edwards was supposed to be a good orator, but he did not do well in that convention hall that night. He somehow just missed his beat, whereas Barack Obama was on time.
You write in your book that as a boy listening to preachers in Atlanta, I understood that first the speaker had to lay a good foundation to give you his text and his subject to tell you what he was going to talk about. Then in the middle part of the speech, I looked for information and inspiration. Even at a young age, I rejected volume and fireworks. That's interesting.
I think I think I learned some of that from my parents, because after the church service, as we sat at dinner, there was an evaluation, and my dad would say, you know, he needed to turn down his volume. And so that evaluation I learned in part from the comments from my parents, who were very devoted to St. Paul EME Church, and we were there every Sunday. And the St. Cecilia Choir Vesper Hours, when leading citizens in the community would come to speak, I was there because I was in the choir, and I listened. Now, I got my job speaking in part while I was in the St. Cecilia Choir, because I couldn't sing very well. So my speaking was much better than my singing.
God taketh away with one hand and giveth with the other.
That is right.
I was fascinated also, as you described this experience of learning how to speak, at the number of occasions in which you participated in oratorical competitions as a very young man.
Yes.
And that this gave you the grounding that you later needed when you were called upon to be, well, you know, when you're the president of the
Easter,
Urban League, you got to speak a lot.
Yeah, the Easter speech programs, this programs on Easter Sunday afternoon, while they were not competitive, the appreciation as expressed in the applause was such that you knew who was more appreciated as the kids came up. And I always did well in that. And because of that, I was put into declamation contests, where you actually say you speak from 1 Corinthians or the 23rd Psalm. You memorize it and you go up and you speak. And I was very successful at that.
And this has undoubtedly benefited you your entire career.
Yes, there's no question about it.
And do we do those kinds of things to this day? Are there enough children doing those kinds of exercises, learning those kinds of skills? And do you think that the example of the president-elect might inspire more of these kinds of exhibitions?
Neil, it's very sad to say that I never heard my daughter give an Easter speech. And that's because things had changed. And when she was growing up, we were in New York, and when I went to Sunday school, she went to something called the Tuesday School in Hartsdale, New York, and it was very different. And I think it was partially the fault of my wife and I, but also it was the tenor of the times. So I never heard my daughter Vicky give an Easter speech, and I regret that.
Hmm. It is where not just preachers but politicians get their grounding. And it is interesting, again, to listen to Barack Obama in his victory speech, and I'm sure you were listening too.
Absolutely.
To hear him read the words of Abraham Lincoln in the cadences of Martin Luther King.
Yes. Yes, that was quite obvious. And it sounded, the rhetoric was not unlike that of Martin.
We want to get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. We're interested in the speech that has most moved you, inspired you, and changed your way of thinking. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Let's begin with Andrew. Andrew with us from Cleveland in Ohio.
Yes. Hi, Neil. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
Yes, this past Democratic convention, Bill Clinton's speech to the Democratic convention this year, I thought was simply amazing. They laid out everything he had to do beforehand, all the pundits, like he was an Olympic gymnast, you know, that this was his routine, this is what he had to accomplish. And especially the line that I'll take away from it was that America must lead by the power of its example, not the example of its power.
Yeah, and did it was inspirational.
I'll never ever forget.
Did it get you to change your mind, or did it get you to change your actions?
No, I'm a pretty staunch Democrat, but it did. However, I live, unfortunately, surrounded by opponents to my way of thought. I live with Republicans. So it did give me quite a good little piece of ammunition when they would you know, go on the negative, and I'd just be like, look, this is, you know, I would throw that quote at them, and it was very powerful. It gives people the time to stop and think about what they're about to say.
Brennan Jordan, what did you think of that speech?
Well, I was there and in Denver, and I thought it was maybe one of Bill Clinton's best speeches. Oftentimes, the circumstances under which the speech is made dictate how people react to it. And if you think about it, President Clinton was sort of on trial, given what had gone on in the primaries.
In South Carolina, yeah.
In South Carolina and other places, and people were not sure about how he would come speak to the convention, which had nominated him twice, and now there was a new nominee who had won over his wife. So there was a lot of tension about how this would come off. And as I have seen him do so many times for so many years, he hit a grand slam. Hmm.
Andrew, thanks very much for the phone call.
And, you know, if I may, you know, I remember back in 2004, my mother called me into her room after Barack Obama got done speaking, and she pointed at the screen, and she looked at me with all severity, and she said, "There's the next president of the United States."
Now, some knew that, and
prophetic.
Some didn't. Vernon Jordan in the latter camp. We'll talk to him about that in just a moment when we get back. We'll talk more with Vernon Jordan and hear one of his memorable speeches that he writes about in the book. Again, it's titled Make It Plain. What was the greatest speech you ever heard, and how did it change your mind or your actions? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conant. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conant in Washington. We're talking with civil rights pioneer and super lawyer Vernon Jordan. He's got a new book out, Make It Plain, Standing Up and Speaking Out, a collection of some of the notable speeches he's given during a lifetime of public speaking. So what was the greatest speech you ever heard? How did it change your mind or your actions? All right, given the flood of emails and telephone calls, we're going to accept the I Have a Dream speech. Everybody's calling in with that one. Give us another nominee, please. Certainly that was the greatest one, probably of our lifetimes, but give us another one, all right? 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And you can also read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. As a young boy, Vernon Jordan was inspired to become a lawyer after hearing an address by Thurgood Marshall, the great civil rights lawyer and the first African-American to sit on the Supreme Court of the United States. Some 50 years later, Vernon Jordan eulogized Marshall at his funeral at Washington, D.C.'s National Cathedral.
Picture, if you will, the inescapable power of the beacon light Thurgood Marshall beamed into our cramped and constricted community. A community in which the law ordained that we should attend only segregated inferior schools. A community in which the law ordained that our parents be denied the right to vote. A community in which the law ordained segregation in the courtroom and the exclusion of our parents from the jury box. It was Thurgood Marshall's mission to turn these laws against themselves, to cleanse our tattered Constitution and our besmirched legal system of the filth of oppressive racism.
And Vernon Jordan, you listen to that, and there's a number of things I wanted to ask you about. They include a tempo and enunciation. But I am most interested in the idea that no matter what technique you have, it doesn't much matter if you don't have the content.
Well, that is the essence of the speech. I have heard speeches or sermons where the eloquence was not there, but if you listened, the content was incredibly good. If you get the combination of both, eloquence and content, then you're in pretty good shape.
Do people make a mistake to forget that this is, in part, a performance?
It is a performance, Neil, and I think the speaker has to be aware of it. Not only be aware of it, but as I said before, you sort of have to like being center stage. Hmm. Because if you like it, I think you will do it better. If you don't like it, if you don't want to be up there, and if you don't appreciate the applause, and if you don't work at getting it, then it does not mean very much to you or the audience.
I was fascinated to read in your book about the number of occasions you went to speak and there would be only a few people in the audience, and there were it was disappointing turnout, but you stressed the importance of going out and giving that audience, no matter how disappointingly small it might be, just as much effort as if the hall was completely packed.
I learned that very early in my career in Telfair County, Georgia, Mr. Alex Horn was president of the local branch of the NAACP. He was also the foreman at the Eugene Talmadge Farm, which was in Telfair County, Georgia. And he was so excited, and he had a program with 10 different preachers and various choirs from various churches. None of them showed up. Less than 10 people. And I had to speak in my overcoat because the church was cold. But I spoke as if there were 800 to 900 people there. And I think about that now when I'm speaking in other places. And I viewed that experience as bread cast upon the water.
It comes back to you.
It does. Yes, it does.
In spades. Well, I'm mixing your metaphors. But anyway, let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Dan, and Dan's with us from Bismarck in Arkansas.
Yes, sir. I wanted to make one comment. I found very interesting. I knew I was going to vote Democratic all along, but after Hillary Clinton's concession speech, basically to Barack Obama, she basically convinced me, gosh, you know, maybe I should vote for her. That speech was so good. And then I was so moved by John McCain's concession speech. And I wonder, you know, do they get cut loose a little bit more? Or what's the difference in their concession speech from what they're doing out on the stump when they're running for the office? It was just both of those were so much more inspirational to me.
It was interesting, Vernon Dorn. A lot of people said after Hillary Clinton's speech and after John McCain's, if they'd only spoken that way during the campaign, they might have won.
Well, I have a view of concession speeches. I concentrate on election night on concession speeches for the reason that I believe the ultimate measure of an individual is not when they win, but when they lose. And therefore, I listen to concession speeches with a great deal of sympathy, and I'm interested in how people in fact articulate defeat. And the ability to do that, I think, says something about the character of the person that loses. I have never taken great joy in anyone's defeat because it's very personal and it's oftentimes hurtful. But you can get a measure of John Kerry in 2004 made a great concession speech. But I think the concession speech, as I said earlier, is a measure of one's character, which is best measured when things are down.
Dan, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Here's some emails we have from Stephanie in Louisville, Kentucky. John Kennedy, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Spurred me into the Peace Corps, she said. This from Thomas in Russell. When I lived in... Oh, this is from Russell about Thomas Jefferson. When I lived in Washington, I several times went down to the Lincoln Memorial at night and read the text of the second inaugural graved in the walls, a special time at a beautiful and sacred site at which to contemplate one of the greatest of American speeches. And again, that was Russell about Abraham Lincoln, of course. Kathleen in West Seneca, New York, writes, one of the most powerful, thoughtful speeches I've heard was the impromptu speech given to the crowd in Indianapolis where Robert F. Kennedy announced the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. While its purpose was to present the horrible news, it was heartfelt and served to accentuate Martin Luther King's aspirations for our country. And this from Liz in Albany, California, maybe not a speech, but Maya Angelou's poem that she read at Bill Clinton's inaugural address was so moving, it got me to get involved with the political process after many years of being too cynical to participate. And I wanted to ask you, do you, Vernon Jordan, read the words of poets who are in some ways doing the same kinds of things and have the same appreciation for the weight of words that an orator does?
Yeah, I think you can't give good speeches if in the preparation of that speech you do not read broadly, widely, as much as you possibly can, to get some sense of breadth and depth, to get some sense of the rhythm of language. Yes, I read a lot. And as a young man, I don't do it much now, I would listen to the radio on Sunday morning, black radio stations where black preachers, some learned, some not so learned, and almost invariably, I would hear a phrase turned that I could appropriate to my own speeches. And I listen whenever I can for at the turn of the phrase in speeches.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Shoberi. Shoberi with us from Palo Alto in California. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yes, correct. Thank you, Neil. Nice to meet you, Vernon.
Thank you.
So, actually, a few years back, I was at my brother's graduation at a local university, San Jose State, and this gentleman, Omid Kordestani, he's the head of Google Sales and Marketing of the global team, and he was very inspiring because being of Iranian-American descent, he is of Iranian-American descent, he told a story about the immigrant's mentality of coming to the United States and living the dream here and kind of over here everything is possible. So his family, he had a struggle where him, his mom, his brother, himself came to the UK, and he said, you know, watching TV that was made in America, it's like, why are we here in the UK, mom? Why don't we go to the United States? And this is when he was around 13 years of age. And then they all decided to come to Palo Alto, California. He studied locally at San Jose State, and then he said, I'm going to get into Stanford. And for 2 years, he kind of network and forced his way into kind of meeting the people here, got into Stanford, and, you know, just going along the pains of working along tough times. But he also, as an entrepreneur, kept on thinking nothing is not possible. Everything is possible mentality. And leaving Netscape to Google, he said to his wife, you know, I could make a good sum of change if we get bought out by AOL, but this startup called Google is a lot of fun, might take a lot of risk now, but the future seems amazing. And since then, it's been an amazing ride for them. And he himself now is like a billionaire, and he has about several thousand employees working under him. So it really inspired me to hopefully become another person like himself.
Well, let us know what company you found, and we'll buy some stock in it before it goes through the roof. Thank you very much, Shoberi, and good luck to you.
You know, Neil, one of the I've given many, many commencement speeches, and one of the great things about it is that you're walking down the aisle of the shuttle, or you're walking through an airport, or you're showing up at a company to do their business, and some young person will walk up to you and say, "You gave my commencement speech," and you said thus and so. There is nothing more gratifying than that, that 10 years later, 15, 20 years later, and that's happened to me, when I've met somebody that I did not know who was graduating, and they remembered.
Here's some more emails we have. This from Gary in Twain Hart in California. The greatest speech I ever heard was the address given by Dominique de Villepin before the UN Security Council just before the invasion of Iraq. Even translated went into English. It was so eloquent that he received applause from an audience that rarely accords such approval. This from Cynthia about John Lewis. You cannot tell people they cannot fall in love. That Representative John Lewis, 1996, in part of a speech for same-sex marriage Congressman Lewis recited an inspiring piece that Martin Luther King gave in defense of interracial marriage. This from David in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. The speech by His Imperial Majesty Emperor Haile Selassie to the League of Nations with respect to the situation in his country, Ethiopia. Words were put into song by Bob Marley, War. And this from Anne in Jacksonville, Florida. A great speech, George W. Bush at the Washington Cathedral after 9/11. I am not a fan of the president, but he did wonderful things in that speech. He spoke of faith, comfort, hope, and peace. And she adds, dead or alive, unfortunately, came later. We're talking with Vernon Jordan about his new book, a collection of some of his speeches, but with notes to put them in context. It's called Make It Plain, Standing Up and Speaking Out. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And one more email that we got, this from Holly in Liverpool, New York. Barbara Jordan's 1976 Democratic Convention speech, I was a 10-year-old girl. Not only did it teach me the power of a woman's deliberate, educated, and passionate voice, but also no one has yet articulated so well the values that to this day I hold dear for myself and my country. And Vernon Jordan, if you've never heard that speech, I'm telling the listeners, I suspect you did, go back and listen to it. I thought maybe one of the greatest political tragedies of our time was the loss of Barbara Jordan.
Well, Barbara was a good friend. We were co-workers when I ran the voter education project of the Southern Regional Council. And she was elected to the Texas legislature along with my roommate from law school, Joseph E. Lockridge. And I went to her funeral with President Clinton. And it was in Houston. It was a very sad moment.
I thought that maybe she would be the first woman and the first African-American president of the United States. Let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is James, and James is with us from Flint in Michigan. James, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead. You're on the line. You're on the air.
Thank you. The greatest speech that I've heard motivated some people to do things was one from Vernon Jordan himself.
Bless you.
I had asked him to come into Flint, Michigan to motivate a group of black administrators to get back on the task of making the organization grow and move. And Vernon did that. He came in for me and gave a speech about an hour and motivated the organization to get back on track. And, in fact, it became a national organization. And I attribute that change and motivation to the speech that Vernon gave that day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Vernon.
Do you remember that speech?
I remember going to Flint, Michigan, and I thought I always went for the local urban league in Flint, but my suspicion is that I was convinced to do it, and I went, but I'm not sure that I would be dishonest if I said I had a clear memory of that.
Here's an email we have from Naomi in Davis, California. Surely one of the most remarkable speeches of the 20th century is Emperor Hirohito of Japan's surrender announcement on August 15th, 1945. Here was a man some Japanese still regarded as a deity, sounding incredibly human and even small, his voice high-pitched, his Japanese oddly formal and scratchy over the airwaves. It brought an end not just to a brutal war, but to an entire era in which Japanese royalty were thought of as not entirely human. And this from Cynthia in Wadsworth, California. The speech by President Reagan after the Challenger disaster really stuck with me. It was a marvelous piece of oratory, quoting the John McGee poem, High Flight, they have slipped the surly bonds of earth to touch the face of God. I think part of the appeal of President-elect Obama is his gift for oratory. And she reminds us, you reminded us earlier, that Bill Clinton could hit a home run every once in a while, too. And certainly Ronald Reagan was one of the better orators of the 20th century. Do you agree?
Yes.
Vernon Jordan, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Neil.
Vernon Jordan joined us from our bureau in New York. He's the managing director of Lazard Frere and, of course, the civil rights pioneer. He spoke of his time with the National Urban League. He also represented at various times branches of the NAACP and the United Negro College Fund. His new book is called Make It Plain, Standing Up and Speaking Out. He joined us today from our bureau in New York.